Well, thank you very much, David, for your kind introduction and for the invitation to speak to you today. I'm not going to talk in the speech in any detail at all about my own country. The topic, as you can see, is the changing landscape of central banking. And that landscape has changed a lot since I started in this business more than three decades ago. Some of the changes that we've seen have been the result of careful system design and changes in the light of long experience. Other changes, and the more prominent ones in recent years, have come in response to exceptional circumstances. They've been necessary, yet unsettling, and we don't really know where they ultimately will lead. So in this talk, I want to reflect on some of those changes, talk about where were we, what happened, where are we now, and in rather more waffly, less detailed terms, where to from here. Let me preface my remarks by saying that I'm not, I repeat, not casting criticisms towards the policies of other central banks. Indeed, my main point, just to repeat, is that some central banks have found themselves doing extraordinary things because of the extraordinary circumstances to which they were required by their mandates to respond as best they could. Even among those central banks who have not found themselves doing the extraordinary, many are operating outside their previous comfort zones and for much the same reason. So where were we? 10 years ago, it seems that the debates about monetary policy had largely been settled. Had one asked about the goals of the central bank, well, the answer, price stability, would very quickly have been given. In some countries, including my own, objectives about real economic activity and or employment remained in legislation, and they still do. In others, particularly the continental European tradition, price stability was the sole objective in law. But even in those countries where a so-called dual mandate was in operation, policymakers overwhelmingly would have said that real activity goals were about managing, to the extent you could, fluctuations around a trend and a potential output path. Monetary policy itself was not thought able to directly affect that potential output path. Now, of course, that was nothing more than the absorption of the fundamental insight of 200 years of monetary theory and experience, and that is that monetary policy in the long run is about nominal magnitudes, not real ones. To the extent that a monetary regime can reduce uncertainty about the level of prices, and then that assists in resource allocation and in encouraging saving and investment, well, that would be monetary policy's main contribution to lifting the average rate of growth. And by the mid to late 80s, I think just about everybody accepted that while the Phillips curve might have a negative short-run slope, in the long run, it was vertical. That consensus also accepted that expectations about inflation matter for actual inflation over relevant horizons. And that, in turn, meant that nominating some sort of numerical objective for inflation came to make sense. That was especially so after targeting measures of the stock of money as an intermediate goal on the way to price stability turned out to deliver less success than we had all hoped. Explicit targets for inflation also helped in another way. It had become widely accepted that the day-to-day conduct of monetary policy needed to be independent of government. That was to avoid the temptation for a short-term stimulus to growth to be sought for political reasons at the cost of a persistent rise in inflation. But of course, in democracies, central banks are creatures of legislatures. So there have to be some limits, some parameters around the central bank's autonomy, and there have to be devices for accountability. Correctly specified, an inflation target offered a solution to that problem. It would allow the central bank to give appropriate weight to output and employment but it would still anchor the price level over the long run, and it would provide a metric to evaluate how well the central bank had used the independence that it had. So by the mid-90s, the consensus across many countries seemed to be that the right sort of regime was some sort of inflation target agreed between the central bank and the government, maybe even set out in legislation, operational independence for the central bank in pursuing the target, and a system of communication and accountability. And through the 90s and the early 2000s, an increasing number of countries adopted some version of that approach, even in the US, where the Fed has very explicitly a dual mandate. They do now articulate a numerical description of what they think price stability means, and they describe that as a goal. So pretty close to the kind of flexible inflation targeting that I describe my own country as following. There were still, of course, in all this, the financial stability goals that were the original raison d'etre, actually, of central banks. It was generally accepted that the appropriate response in a liquidity panic would be to provide funds to solvent financial institutions against collateral at an interest rate related to but above the prevailing market rate. If you had a system-wide increase in demand for liquidity, that would almost automatically be handled by operations which were designed to keep the overnight rate or some other short-term rate at the target level. Only in extraordinary cases would something more than that be needed, and such events were thought to be likely to be very rare. So for some years, the modus operandi of a developed country central bank involved setting a short-term interest rate and adjusting it incrementally in response to forecast deviations of inflation and/or output from the desired path. Occasionally, the central bank would move the policy rate more quickly in response to a shock thought likely to affect the outlook in a major way. Observed changes in asset values would be assessed through the lens of their implications for the growth forecast. And on occasion, if there was a rapid decline in asset values, although that might evoke a monetary policy response if it was thought likely to have a significant economic effect. The results of this framework seem to be good. After all, we were living through the Great Moderation, so-called. The actions were relatively uncontroversial, and there was generally reasonable political support for that system. So that's where we were, the good old days, which came to an end just not long after I took this role. So unfortunately, then, things got more complicated. As you all know, the materialisation of some of the risks that had built up in the financial system, followed by a financial crisis, deep recessions, slow recoveries, has meant that much more has been demanded of central banks in recent years, especially those in the major jurisdictions. That started in the second half of 2007, when unusually large interventions were required to keep money markets functioning in Europe. Then, truly extraordinary actions were required in a number of jurisdictions following the failure of Lehman's in September 2008. The complete breakdown of funding between intermediaries, the closure of important segments of the capital markets, and the loss of public confidence in major financial institutions were more severe than any previous event of its kind over a number of decades. This required very forceful interventions by central banks and by governments. A potential debt default spiral had to be averted. Assets had to be liquefied. Private funding that had disappeared had to be replaced in key instances by central bank funding. And not least, public confidence in deposit-taking institutions had to be restored, using guarantees and in some cases injections of public capital. This wasn't an idiosyncratic event limited to one institution or even one country, it was systemic. The most acute problems clearly were in the North Atlantic countries, but the ramifications were global. Well, those actions, controversial as they were and still are in some cases, really were the only course available to the decision makers at the time. Lengthy retrospective critical evaluations carried out in the relatively calm years afterwards are the prerogatives of historians, academics, journalists, and legislatures. There is, of course, a lot of hindsight judgment in much of that, and in some cases, not a little unfairness. But the point is that the fact that that occurs simply marks the unusual territory that central banks and governments were forced to traverse. For this was more than just the injection of liquidity as a response to a brief panic. The threat to real economic activity was so dire that the stance of monetary policy had to be changed aggressively. Economic activity, as we all know, turned down very sharply all around the world in those closing months of 2008. So interest rates were slashed, and in the major jurisdictions they quickly reached very low levels or effectively zero. That wasn't enough to prevent major or many countries entering deep recessions or subsequently to generate reasonable recoveries. And so so-called unconventional measures were rolled out to try to provide additional stimulus. This has been quite striking. Central banks' balance sheets prior to the crisis in a developed country were typically of the order of 5 to 10% of GDP in size. Bank of Japan was already bigger than that because they'd been doing quantitative measures for a while. Now, central bank balance sheets, say in the US or Europe, are 25 to 30% of GDP. And the Bank of Japan is on a path that will take it to around 90% of Japanese GDP. So clearly a very big change from where they had been. Balance sheet measures may have begun as a direct intervention to stabilise the financial system, but they're now long-running measures aimed at monetary policy goals. Monetary policy is being asked, it seems to me, to return output to potential by boosting demand after a severe demand downturn caused in large part, by over-leverage. And the problem here, of course, is that if leverage is too high and needs to be reduced, then monetary policy by itself may not be as effective at generating demand as people might wish. 20 years ago, with a latent demand for more leveraged spending, it seems to me it wasn't that hard to stimulate growth in demand with lower interest rates, at least not in the Anglosphere or the Nordic countries. But it seems much harder now. And I think it's worth remembering here that monetary policy per se doesn't directly create spending. Fiscal policy does, but monetary policy doesn't. What it does is it alters a relative price. And there's a whole bunch of effects that come from that, but there are two of major significance to think about. The first one is that you redistribute income between savers and borrowers. In the wake of a financial crisis associated with over-leverage, monetary policy can, by lowering interest rates, lessen the burden on the indebted part of the economy by shifting the burden, in part, to the net holders of interest-earning assets. That will lessen the negative feedback from debt to spending, and that in turn helps to stop aggregate spending from falling as much as it might otherwise do, even though we have to keep in mind that asset holders at some point whose income has been reduced will start to reduce their own spending. The second effect, of course, is to alter the incentives faced by private and public sectors in deciding whether to spend today or on a future day. But if people are less responsive to that because they are still highly levered, monetary policy is less powerful in the short term. Now, that might just be temporary. It may be that once the so-called balance sheet repair channel of low interest rates has been working for long enough for the repair to be largely complete, then maybe people will respond with additional spending in the same way they used to. In that case, monetary policy will still be as effective, but with just longer lags. On the other hand, if there's been a persistent shift in attitudes to debt, spending and saving, then monetary policy's weaker ability to generate short-term growth might just be part of the new normal. So while it's beyond argument that central bank actions in the crisis headed off what could have been a catastrophe, it is another thing, I think, to say that monetary policy can easily restore enough demand to fully employ the economy's labour and capital doing what they were doing prior to the crisis. The evidence for the effectiveness of these policies is strongest in the US, but even there, it's taken quite a while for recovery to gain momentum. If ultra-low rates and quantitative measures were powerful, I would have thought they should have produced more demand and presumably more inflation by now. Now, of course, some critics of these policies thought that would be the answer. They thought that high inflation would in fact occur, and they've been wrong about that. If anything, inflation looks a little too low globally, notwithstanding the extent of monetary easing in the world that we've had. Other critics would say that if the desired effects have been slow to emerge, then that's only because the dosage was too small and you should have just done more. Well, maybe that's right. Or maybe, and I suspect this is the answer, the evidence is telling us that at whatever dosage, monetary policy can only do so much and that other tools might need to be used as well. That isn't to say that monetary authorities were wrong to implement these policies, far from it. It's only to say that they were perhaps bound to find that their efforts were of only limited power. At any rate, it's still proving difficult to generate demand. Financial risk-taking has increased, driven by the search for yield, but real economy risk-taking, so-called, is rather more difficult to find. Corporations sit on stockpiles of cash, in many cases apparently reluctant to accept lower returns on investment projects in spite of the lowest cost of debt funding ever seen. Capital is returned to shareholders. What do they do with it? Well, frequently they're faced with alternative options which earn even less than their money would have earned in the corporation who's just given it back to them. At the same time, it's increasingly apparent that the ultra-low returns on offer on financial instruments are going to make it exceedingly difficult for the provision of retirement incomes. That's an issue that I think will grow in prominence over the years ahead. Although it now seems that the zero lower bound for nominal interest rates wasn't actually zero, because some countries have actually gone below zero, it's not clear that those recently implemented negative rates by a handful of central banks in Europe offer some new vista of policy effectiveness. The incidence of negative rates that society will accept may be somewhat narrow. And here I would refer you to a recent very interesting speech by Jamie McAndrews from the New York Fed, which outlines a number of respects in which negative rates, if attempted on a widespread basis over a long period, could in fact be very disruptive, and in ways not likely to be expansionary for growth. It hasn't helped, of course, that many governments feel that they have insufficient scope for stimulus on the budgetary side. In the contemporary jargon, they lack so-called fiscal space. Now, in some cases, that is a result of poor fiscal discipline over a long period. In others, it's more the result of the size of the debt build-up caused by the depths of the crisis itself. Whatever the backdrop, though, if the perceived limits to debt sustainability are close, then governments will tend to feel that fiscal stimulus today must be accompanied by a credible promise to reverse it tomorrow. Well, that promise, if kept, would certainly keep the debt trajectory largely unchanged over the long term. But it may also negate the very power of the policy to generate growth beyond a very short horizon. You have to have a lot of faith, actually, in the power of temporary pump priming to think otherwise. On the other hand, many would argue that since the track record in so many cases suggests that once public borrowing starts, governments find it very hard to stop, maybe that conservatism is for the best. Meanwhile, central banks' long-standing general concern for safeguarding financial stability has taken on more of an edge and is now less easily dissociated from monetary policy. There's still a tendency, of course, as there was prior to the crisis, for financial stability and monetary policy work in central banks to be organised in separate silos. The monetary policy people think about output gaps and inflation. The financial stability people think about asset prices and leverage and how to strengthen resilience. And of course, the current thinking there is that regulatory tools should be deployed in response to those concerns. While it certainly seems logical enough to ensure stronger capital standards in the banks and to lean into the credit cycle with such tools as you have, if you can. That's all very sensible. Yet this neat separation between financial stability and the central bank's other macroeconomic goals might be just a little too neat. I wonder whether it shouldn't leave us just a little bit uneasy. For a start, experience of an earlier era of regulation, and I remember it well, counsels against putting a lot of faith in regulatory measures alone. Not only that, but it's surely a lesson of the crisis that monetary policy and financial stability do interact. Monetary policy works, after all, by altering financial prices and asset values. Lowering interest rates doesn't conjure up demand through some process of immaculate conception. It works, when it works, at least partly, by affecting risk-taking, by affecting borrowing and saving decisions. The central bank, by setting the rate of interest, is effectively setting the price of leverage. It's abundantly clear that leverage matters for financial stability. In fact, few things matter more. Now, people have stopped short of saying that the goal of monetary policy should be changed from price stability to financial stability, and I'm not saying that, though it strikes me as not impossible that a decade from now some people will be saying that. But certainly, I think today people have more misgivings than they once might have had about attempts to meet inflation and/or unemployment mandates that ignore the financial implications of the interest rate settings necessary to achieve those goals. So let me give an example. Suppose a country faces an insufficiency of aggregate demand and below target inflation, but it can only generate the demand needed to close the gap and push inflation up to the target by fostering a rise in private sector leverage. So then the question is, how aggressively should the central bank seek to increase demand and return inflation to the target? Well, the answer presumably depends on several considerations. One of them would be how well anchored inflation expectations are. The better anchored they are, the less risk of a damaging decline into very low or deflationary expectations from an extended period of subdued growth. Surely another consideration, though, is whether leverage in the private sector has previously been low or high. If it's low, then some increase is probably fine, and you can go ahead and stimulate, push up demand, and get inflation back to target quickly. On the other hand, if leverage is already high, perhaps as a result of an earlier run-up, and if the weakness in demand is in part a result of the private sector being cautious about further extensions of leverage or even attempting to reduce its leverage, then in that world, the central bank may face a rather unenviable set of choices. So the point is that there's an intersection between the Phillips curve world of output gaps and inflation targets and what you could call the Irving Fisher Hyman Minsky world of low frequency cycles in risk appetite and leverage. The financial sector isn't just an appendage to the real economy, passively responding to the course of output and prices. It's through the financial sector that monetary policy works. And sometimes, problems that build up in the financial sector can have powerful effects on the real economy that monetary policy might find it difficult or impossible to offset. And so a sense of when and how that can happen is very important for monetary policy. So where does that leave us? Clearly, the role of central banks has become much more prominent and at the same time considerably more complex and potentially more controversial than it was in those happy days of the Great Moderation. More has been asked of central banks, Under circumstances in which monetary policy might reach the limits of effectiveness, and yet at a time when it seems that the ability of other macroeconomic policies to contribute to growth has lessened. A previous generation of central bankers who fought lengthy battles to rid their respective countries of high inflation are surely looking on at all this in disbelief. Central bank balance sheets have become dominant forces in a wider range of financial markets. They've always been dominant in a narrow range of markets, but now they're much bigger forces across a wider range. Some people argue that the market's normal functions of risk pricing have been distorted or overwhelmed by central bank actions. And to those critics, the search for yield is an artificial and dangerous phenomenon caused by central bank intervention. The central banks would counter, of course, that they had no choice but to pursue such actions, and that in any event, there have probably been other factors at work, real factors, that have been holding down real interest rates. Either way, central banks in some jurisdictions anyway seem likely to be large players in markets for quite some time yet, and the manner and pace of eventual normalisation of balance sheets will surely at some point become a major challenge for private participants. Nor is it just in their transactions that central banks have become very conspicuous. In their efforts to add power to their easy monetary policy stances, central banks have sought to offer guidance on their future behaviour. They've taken pains to spell out the sorts of conditions under which they would adjust policy, and even on occasion given some sense of the likely pace. The forthcoming liftoff, as they call it, by the Federal Reserve, when it happens, will surely be the most telegraphed monetary policy adjustment in history. And that's all very sensible. Words matter in this business just as much as actions. The problem, of course, is that a central bank cannot realistically state how it will respond to all possible future states of the world. And in any event, to be honest, it seems to me many market participants, commentators, journalists and so on are actually not that interested in the nuance and conditionality that usually surrounds central banks' careful utterances. They simply want to know what will happen and when. Well, we all do, but that's their focus. And they will distill things down into a simple story, one simple story or another, and put the central bank into one pigeonhole or another. As I was writing this, an analogy occurred to me from something I was reading. You know, in a remote part of Western Australia, about 300 kilometres to the northeast of Geraldton, so for those of you that know the geography, it's pretty remote, there's a construction to take place over the years ahead of our part of something called the Square Kilometre Array Project. This is an international project. It's headquartered actually not far from here in Manchester. And as the name suggests, the idea is to have multiple radio telescopes over a large area of the Earth's surface, many of these in the southern hemisphere, which in effect increases the effective size of the total receiver antenna, hence the name Square Kilometre. And that array of antenna, it's said, will be able to detect the faintest energy emanating from distant stars, even ones billions of light years away from the Earth. Well, you can't help but think of the financial markets and the media when you think of that. Countless antenna all over the world, trained on the faint sound of the central bank voice, trying to discern and amplify signals out of all the static. And that's even when the central bank has no new signal to send and static is all there is. So the lesson that a recovery from a downturn associated with a period of financial excesses almost always proves to be a slow one has been learned once again. Central banks have to do what they can to speed up that process. Together with governments, they can and did avert a catastrophe, a catastrophic contraction. They can and have run an extended period of easy money, including by being innovative with their own balance sheets. And in all likelihood, very accommodative policies will continue for quite a while. During that period, central banks will have little choice but to rely in part on regulatory tools to try to contain potential financial excesses without actually much convincing evidence of the power of those tools. But they will also have to learn to live, it seems to me, without the earlier neat distinction between monetary policy and financial stability. In the end, of course, central bank policies can't restore the situation ex ante. Whatever adjustments economies needed to make and may still need to make in respect of financial and or economic structure from the pre-crisis situation can't be avoided. Those adjustments are ongoing. I'm optimistic enough to think that in due course they will have advanced sufficiently that stronger growth accompanied by less extreme central bank policy settings could be anticipated. Needless to say, the more other policies outside of the central bank's ambit can contribute to that, the better. And that, of course, was the whole point of the pro-growth commitments the G20 leaders made when we hosted the meeting in Brisbane in November of 2014. None of those commitments are about monetary policy, actually. They're all about what you could call supply-side policies. So the more of that we can have, the better. But in conclusion, it seems to me that it will be some time before the central banking modus operandi that we had back in those happy days prior to the crisis is seen again. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Glenn. That was a very searching speech, I think, and at the risk of falling into the trap that you set us of trying to make everything simple, I would sum it up very, very, in very short words, as saying central banks are important, but they can't do everything. But I do hope we'll continue with a slightly more nuanced line. I was struck by a couple of things, and maybe if you'd allow me to open up the questioning before we go to the floor. As well as this idea of the world of the Phillips curve and output gaps meeting the world of Irving Fisher and Hiram Minsky, and I thought this is a real task for you when you eventually leave the RBA, as well as that, I was struck by this talk about the antennae and the square kilometre, and I thought you were going to say that the one distinguishing feature that links, say, journalists and people in the markets with this square kilometre is the extraordinary barrenness of the terrain and the desire to go out for a lot of drinks in the evening. But you don't have to elaborate on that point. The two issues that I'd like to ask you about, just to kick off here, you mentioned the fact that central banks are extraordinarily prominent, extraordinarily complex, and also more controversial. You also mentioned the issue about transparency and communication and accountability, all very, very difficult. Where do you think in the world, what country or group of countries would you like to say we could look to for, not for the ideal solution, for a kind of role model? And then secondly, you spoke at length about the great moderation. It came up, and of course that ended, as you said, more or less when you took over the helm.
Wasn't my fault.
No coincidence there. But would you like to just say a few more words about why we were lulled into that, what seems now like a trap of complacency, just before we get going on the more forward-looking issues? Would you like to just say a few more words about why that great moderation was seen by almost everybody as an ideal state that was going to lead to stability and low inflation and growth in the future? You know, what was the reason for that?
Well, so they're good questions. Let me take up those. The barrenness of the terrain, yes. The structure is being built on a station way out there, and I'm not sure there's a local pub to go to in the evening.
Don't Australians have a way of getting around?
It could be. Role models. I think central banks learn a lot from each other. My observation would be that there's a lot of comparison of ways of doing things, and it's not in a spirit of mine's better than yours. It's just in a spirit of seeing how other people do things, and quite often there are little takeaways as to the way that things might be improved. I think the central banks of the major jurisdictions, I would have to say those institutions and their leaders have my sympathy, because the task that they've faced is so difficult, probably impossible, and the intensity of the scrutiny is extraordinary. So that's all very difficult, but I don't think that I'd claim that any one country has this exactly right. I wouldn't claim that about my own country. I think it's better to have an attitude of continual learning, and we've certainly learned a lot in these past 8 or 9 years that I've been in this role. On the great moderation, I think that's a very interesting question. Because the great moderation, by definition, what is that? That was a period of much reduced volatility in economic output, in inflation, in interest rates, and so on. Now, one could make a mistaken diagnosis. So it would have been, I think, a little bit dangerous to have concluded that that was entirely due to good monetary policy. I think good monetary policy contributed. I don't think the central banks would have claimed, and we certainly wouldn't have, that this was all our doing. But something happened. It was a remarkably stable period. And so, in a sense, it was quite rational at the time, after a period like that, or at least you can understand why people felt that macroeconomic riskiness was reduced. And if that's the case, you can see why people felt it was safer to have higher leverage. You don't feel it's safe to have higher leverage when things are very volatile, but when things are not very volatile, unless you know that's very temporary, it would have seemed safer to people to have more leverage, and indeed that's what they did. That higher leverage itself, of course, helped to sow the seed for the end of the Great Moderation, because it meant that when a shock came, the kind of reactions that people have to make because of the higher leverage are more acute. So they seem like a distant, fond memory now. I'm not sure that we still have a terribly good explanation of why things seemed to be so low in volatility then. We can tell the story of what the trigger was that made the change to the world we're in now. I'm still not sure that we have that good an understanding of why we were in that previous world for quite some time. And when you look back, it's certainly true that risk spreads and things like that were highly compressed, and there were people who were saying this doesn't feel right in the financial space, there's very little compensation for risk, something's going to go wrong. They weren't able to say, not many people, no one that I know anyway, was able to say it will go wrong in US subprime mortgages in beginning in early 2007, which is what happened. But there were people who were saying that this very skinny compensation for risk seems odd, seems dangerous, and I'm sort of uneasy. So there were people saying that. Even there are earlier periods in history when risk compensation was similarly skinny, and that actually persisted. If you go back through the 20th century, there were periods like that, and they persisted for some time in some instances. So, history is complex and interesting, and I'm not sure that we have all the answers as to why we were in that period that we do have.
Good. Well, thank you very much for opening the batting and taking the shine off the new ball, shall we say. So let's have a few questions from the audience. Perhaps it would be nice if, when you get up and speak, you... Yes, please, so Xian, from the back. We've got a microphone here. Please say who you are as well. That would be nice. And we expect a similar kind of Richie Beno-type deadpan delivery here.
Shaheen Valley from Soros Fund Management. One question about the good old days. Could it be actually that the good old days were an extraordinary time and that we will never go back to it? Because if you think of central banking before the good old days, it was a central banking that's somewhat similar to the one we have now, with central banks very involved in the allocation of credit, with large balance sheets, and actually expanded their reach beyond what we consider is the narrow purview of monetary policy now, but also extended to macroprudential policies to a large degree. So could it be that the times you describe as the good old days are in fact just an extraordinary short period of time that we will never see again? And another related question, you mentioned, you sounded like a monetarist, but at the same time you implied that there were limits to what central banks could do. Are you of the view that structural reforms and structural policies are what should accompany monetary policy in order to be able to achieve the inflation targets that central banks have set themselves? Or would you rather think that fiscal policy is the tool that is underutilized and that should be coordinated more with monetary authorities? Thank you.
Good, please.
Thank you. Were the good old days just a fluke? Well, you didn't say that. Were they a remarkably benign but historically very unusual period? That's entirely possible. It is true, as you say, that in the preceding period, which I would class as from the late 60s through to, say, the middle of the 1980s, that was a period where central banking was more difficult, and it was basically the long flight to rid countries of inflation, which in the end was largely successful. Prior to that, I think if you think back to the post-World War II era, central bank balance sheets did tend to be a bit bigger, I think, because the private sector financial system had the shattering effect of the Great Depression. Then there'd been a war, so the conditions for... And there was a heavy regulation, so conditions for private sector financial growth weren't really in place for a while. And central banks in those days were often obliged to keep bond rates low because there was a lot of government debt outstanding. You forced the banks to hold it at probably below market yields because the government wanted to contain debt servicing costs, and because... Also, the other holders who'd bought bonds during wartime and so on, people didn't want them to suffer a capital loss if rates rose and all that sort of thing. That was the post-war legacy, and it took a long time for that to fade into history, and that was accompanied by the growth of the private sector financing and international capital markets and so on. So there are these long eras, and it's possible, I suppose, that we just had a remarkably benign period for, say, 15 years with the Great Moderation, and we'll never see it again. I don't think we're going to see it again soon. That is certainly my view. I think it's still a long way back to that world for most countries. On your second question, I'm not a monetarist, if by that we mean exceptionally strong faith in the quantity theory of money per se, but I do think that the main insight that monetary policy is ultimately about nominal magnitudes in the long run, I still think that's true, and we need to not lose sight of that. Structural policies, whatever your inflation objective, whether you're meeting it or not, it's very hard to think of circumstances under which structural policies that make the economy work better, that lift your average level of productivity, possibly increase its rate of growth, but certainly lift its level. It's hard to think of a time when that would not be a good idea under whatever monetary regime you have. So the whole point, as I say, of the G20 growth commitment was on that side. It wasn't fiscal activism, it wasn't money printing, it was entirely about things that governments can do to to boost the flexibility and adaptability and supply capability of their economies so as to boost long-run living standards. That's really what that was about. And it strikes me as almost never the case that doing structural reforms wouldn't be a good idea. Whether fiscal should be used, I think that is a more nuanced question. You know, if you think you're in a liquidity trap, then what we all learned at university was that was the moment to use fiscal, and fiscal was used. Let's be frank. It was used in the heat of the crisis, and I think with good effect. The difficulty comes in, I suppose, trying to form an assessment of how much fiscal space you have, and that's actually not a straightforward question to answer, but it's apparent that at least some governments in the world have felt that their space was constrained, and that's limited what they felt they could do on countercyclical fiscal. But in principle, if you have the space, there's at least consideration can be given to the optimal combination of monetary expansion and fiscal, certainly.
Thank you. Let's have a next question. Yes, so Ken Sullivan down here.
Ken Sullivan, formerly Reserve Bank of New Zealand and the IMF. What I would like to get your thoughts on, Governor Stevens, is really the emergence of the dual mandate in central bank functionality, particularly the reference to financial stability. It's a sort of a catch-all phrase, and I'd really like your thoughts on, first of all, what you think the scope of the financial system is that the central bank should be responsible for the stability of, and secondly, what is stability? We probably agree in retrospect that 30 times leverage isn't particularly stable, but what are the mandates that drive the central bank's actions here? And also, what effect does this additional mandate have on the concept of central bank independence in an area where financial system stability is a highly political concept? Thank you.
Thank you very much. As I was also struck by what you said about in 10 years' time, you couldn't totally rule out that financial stability might actually advance to priority. So,
well, it's a good question, and it's an interesting use of the term dual mandate, actually, because in common language up to this point, dual mandate's been taken to mean unemployment or growth and inflation, and that is certainly the sense in which the Fed uses it still. But is there a notion of dual mandate with price stability and financial stability? I suppose my starting point would be that I don't really think that those things ought to be seen as in conflict in the longer term, but long term's pretty long. Because the financial cycle can be a 10 or 15-year cycle. The business cycle that we're currently working on with our, you know, Phillips curve world is 7 years, say. And so to marry the two requires a certain ability to be flexible over a business cycle horizon if you think that the stability risks and financial side are building up. But so they're not necessarily, I don't think they should be seen as inconsistent or in conflict, but in practice it's not necessarily straightforward to marry them. That would be the first point. Another question you raised was how do we define financial stability, and I agree with you, it's more easily defined by its absence. We know it when we don't see it, so to speak. And much of the rest of the time, we've got these various metrics that we track that we think will give us a steer if stability might be at risk. But even there, what's the correct household debt to income ratio? Is it 100? Is it 150 like ours is? Is it much less, much more? Well, only ex post can you say that was too high. So it's difficult. But the fact that it's difficult, that some things are unobservable, that doesn't necessarily mean, I don't think, that you shouldn't attempt it. What's the natural rate of interest or the NARU? You can't observe those either, other than ex post knowing, yes, we were above or below. by inferring it from the behaviour of the economy. So I think as difficult as defining stability is, the cost of not having it to the community is clearly very high. We don't want to be there, and we've got to try to find some ways of shoring it up. And I suppose my main point is that I personally don't think that it's reasonable anymore to say that monetary policy is just the Phillips curve mandate and, you know, we'll handle stability. The supervisor will handle it or we'll use a regulation. I think monetary policy does interact, and I think we have to be cognizant of that. The question of independence is an important one, and I think this line's already been blurred, really. If you think about cases where central banks have purchased a lot of government debt. True, they're not directly funding the government by crediting their bank account and letting them spend it. But is what they're doing all that far removed from that? If central banks buy a size of debt equivalent to the annual budget deficit, that's not quite monetary financing, but it's certainly an activity that's very accommodative of fiscal policy. And I'm not saying it's wrong. I'm not saying that. But already the lines are a little bit blurred. Then when you get into if you have to end up rescuing financial institutions, the lines get blurred further. So that need independence of the two policies in that sort of world can't be as neat as we might have hoped. But that's just the reality that we live in. I think what is critical is for the central bank to retain independence of action and independence of thought and as much clarity in its mandate as is possible, so that this blurring doesn't lead to a deterioration in overall performance. And that hasn't happened so far, at least. But the point you raise is a good one, that the lines are potentially here a little more blurry than they used to be, and that's the messy world that we're in.
Thank you. Yes, there's a batch of questions. So please, David. Yeah, thanks. We might actually bundle together a couple of questions here.
That's good, and I can pick which one to answer.
That's right.
Yeah. Good morning. David Simmons from RBS. Could you update us on RBA's view on China's economy, the extent to which that's complicating the rebalancing of Australia's economy away from primary commodities towards something else, and the role that a weaker Australian dollar may need to play in that transition? Thanks.
Okay, and let's have the gentleman behind you, or next to you, please. Yes, whoever it was, you, please.
Hi, Virgil Mendoza. I think that you'll agree that the challenges that central banks going forward will face are different in the developed world compared to developing economies. And I just wanted your thoughts of what your advice would be to developing country central banks on how to face the challenges that the takeoff that you referred to will place upon them.
Good, thank you. Two questions.
China, RBA's view, no particular things to add to what we've published already, and my views on the role of the exchange rate are well known. I have don't add or subtract to them. We've been saying that further depreciation is both likely and necessary, so no change to that language. China, the other thing I've said is that the managing down of the asset prices leverage story, that's a work in progress, it still is. I think the Chinese authorities are well attuned to the issues and have the tools to deal with it, but of course it'll be a work in progress for a while and we have to just accept that. Advice for emerging markets. I don't really want to give gratuitous public advice. I receive plenty of it, but I don't usually try to give too much. I think one thing that can be said is that the taper tantrum, so-called, served as a wake-up call for many countries to kind of get the house a bit better in order, and they have. I think in a number of countries in the, as what you call the emerging world, they understood that. They've been strengthening their fundamentals as best they can, and they're probably, I would say, now in a much better place to manage as liftoff happens. The term liftoff, of course, is kind of connotes a vertically rising rocket. I don't think it's going to be that vertical. I think it will likely be gradual. But I think the emerging countries are as well placed as they can be, and many of them would probably be happy for it to happen sooner rather than later at this point, I'm inferring.
I mean, just to get it out of the way.
Well, I think the Fed understands this also, that, you know, there's a certain uncertainty that will be presumably lessened once an action eventually occurs. Then the focus would shift onto the slope, of course. Mm. And that's something the Fed would also be highly cognizant of and will no doubt carefully manage.
Thank you. Peter Stella. I was formerly head of the Central Banking Division at the IMF. When you were going back to discuss the sort of situation in the 1980s, you remarked on the importance of expectations formation and sort of the revolution, rational expectations revolution led to central banks becoming really revolutionary in their communication strategy, more transparent, regular meetings, press conferences, explanations of their targets and how they're going about them. I feel as though that morphed maybe in the 90s and 2000s into not only being transparent, but trying to become very predictable. And transparency and predictability aren't the same thing, naturally. And I wonder if you have any view that I'm kind of leaning towards since Greenspan, maybe in February 94, in the U.S. in particular, the Fed has been so obsessed with not taking the market by surprise. And could that have led to or facilitated the buildup in leverage? In other words, trying to eliminate small bits of volatility might have led to a lot of leverage and set up the pace for a big, very highly volatile moment. But my question is really about going forward. Do you think there's any view among central bankers that being so predictable maybe isn't 100% positive, that maybe having a little unpredictability while being transparent would be good and might even lead to more financial stability?
I think there's a key distinction between predictability and I suppose what you could call understandability. I think what central banks have been trying to do is to be understandable. You could describe that as they try to make their reaction function as clear as they can. Now, even that, what's my reaction to a whole host of hypothetical things that could occur? I don't know. I can't, as I said in the talk, you can't say how we will behave in every conceivable state of the world. It's just not tractable. But the point of inflation targeting, in a sense, is people know the objective. They know the modus operandi. They know that inflation's high or threatening to be high, the central bank will likely tighten, and it will do what's needed to achieve the target on average, and vice versa when it's low. That's not the same as predictability, because predictability of the central bank requires predictability of the economy. And the economy is not that predictable. Forecasting is more art than science, and forecasts, I think, are better than they used to be, but the central bank can only be fully predictable if the economy to which it responds is fully predictable, and that's never likely to be seen. So I think the central bank can articulate, this is how we think about things, this is what we think is happening in the economy, and if things evolve as we think, then we'll probably do A, B, or C. But you've got to keep in mind always that is a working hypothesis based on an outlook, which is a probabilistic thing itself. And the central bank knows full well that it could be doing something quite different in a year from what it presently thinks it will be doing if the economy is doing something different. And I think that's... So the inherent thing is we can go a fair way to explaining to people what the policy regime is, what the reaction function is, if you like. We probably can't go as far as people would like, but we can do some. What we can't do is make the economy entirely predictable, and therefore there are always going to be surprises because the central bank itself is surprised, and that is a fact of nature that we can't go away. I don't think there's a... I personally don't think that central banks think that deliberate unpredictability would be good. I don't think we think that. I think we often despair at the inability of the people that are listening to us to understand the nuance that the guidance that is given, whether it's a lot or a little, is highly conditional. I think that people don't understand that as well as they really should, and that's a job for us, I guess.
I'm sure that'll all change from today.
Pardon me?
That'll all change from
now. I very much doubt that. Yeah.
So there's a gentleman there, please. Here's a,
My name is Bill Shadwick. I'm from Omega Analysis. Back in 2001, I think it was, after the tech bubble burst, Charles Goodhart suggested, among many others, that central banks needed to widen their view of what constituted inflation, and the runaway stock markets were something that ought to be thought about. Mm. Leaving aside any idea of what the central bank might do about such things, do you think central banks ought to be paying attention to these things? Some people would certainly say that a lot of the missing inflation is to be found in equity market prices. And after all, major crashes do result in reductions, significant reductions of GDP. Mm. So I'd just like to have your comments on that.
Well, I think that central banks do pay attention to large build-ups in asset prices. It's all central banks would say, well, we take account of that, whatever, and take account can mean different things to different people, of course. I think it's a much further step to say we're going to compute some kind of aggregate price index that's a weighted average of consumer prices and a bunch of asset prices. I don't really know how you do that, and we've thought about this sort of thing quite a lot over the years. So I think the right thing to do is to maintain for the target variable some kind of goods and services price index. But I think where asset prices come into importance is it's less the asset price per se than the leverage, if any, behind it. If I take the tech bubble as an example, yes, there was a bubble in tech that popped. Who died? Well, a lot of people that had invested in certain high-tech things lost money, but the economy, the real economy of the US, suffered not that much, actually. How come? Well, I would submit that the main reason is that the bubble in the NASDAQ, if that's what we want to call it, really wasn't highly levered. Very different story, as it turned out, with housing prices, or historically, usually what's gotten countries into most trouble consistently through time is commercial property, highly levered. So asset prices tell you something. What you should do about them hinges a lot on whether they're levered or not. If we have a bubble in the price of rare art or stamps, well, who cares? Because A, it's not that widespread a hell class. There's no banking system that's going to come down as a result. Houses, very different story. So the leverage matters. What you do, well, that's where we get to which tool. And the current conventional wisdom is, well, you'd use regulatory tools. I'm not against that. My view is we may find down the track that they have some value, but regulation on its own may not be sufficient to contain all these dynamics over the longer term if we keep the price of money incredibly low. That's a judgment call because we don't know the answer yet. So I think, in summation, asset prices do matter. Whether the boom is leveraged is the critical thing.
Question from Reuters, a fine, outstanding news agency.
Why you no longer work for them?
No. Well, they will be eventually paying me my pension.
Very good.
Sorry, I would stand, but it's a bit tricky at the moment. But I just wanted to see if you could give us your thoughts on Greece and the kind of central bank response there, and whether that has any, you're making any contingency plans at home to inject any liquidity into the Australian market if that was deemed to be necessary.
Thank you.
I don't have any gratuitous advice for the ECB or the Euro ministers or for the Greek government. They've got to manage the situation. In terms of our exposures, Australia's exposures are minuscule directly, so I would anticipate that there's unlikely to be material issues for us unless there was a major ruction in global markets, and in that world everybody's affected. And that's as much as one needs to say, I think, at the moment. I think we're in good shape.
Eugene Maslov, Fenton Capital. Somewhat related to the previous question, what are your views on the capacity of central banks to react to challenges and the risk elements in the global economy in an environment where, to quote the chief economist of the Bank of England, the interest rates are already glued to the floor?
Well, I think the thrust of your question is that there is less interest rate ammunition, so to speak, left. That's obviously, as a piece of arithmetic, is true. The potential to use the balance sheet, if you think that's a good idea, is in principle unlimited. The question is how powerful that is, and my own view would, I think the thrust of my talk is that monetary policy can only do so much. Monetary policy has to do what it can, but what it can do is not enough for the situation that a number of countries face. That is why every other policy tool that governments have has to be pro-growth. That doesn't mean profligate fiscal expansion if you're already over-indebted, but there ought to be structural things that can be pro-growth, and the trick will be to make them pro-growth quickly. And there are some things that probably could be pro-growth reasonably soon, but the point about monetary policy is it can and should and will do what it can, but what it can do mightn't be enough per se. That's the reality.
That was also quite a good succinct summing up of your speech, I think.
Thank you. Matthias Müller-Goldman, maybe following on from that previous questions, what do you see as some of the key risks in financial markets at the moment? There has been increasing talk about drying up of liquidity, and especially in recent weeks, increasing talk about systemic risk of asset management. And then in the UK, there's a big focus on conduct. What do you see as some of the key risks at the moment? Thank you.
Well, you've mentioned several important things. I think there is a sense in my discussions with private market participants that the underlying liquidity of many markets is not what it used to be. There are a number of reasons that people advance for that, but regardless of what you think about those reasons, it seems to be a fact. And that is a potential challenge when the interest rate tide turns, as it's anticipated to do, at least in the US. I think it's a long time yet before that happens in some of the other major jurisdictions, like Japan or Europe. That's a challenge, certainly. The conduct matters. Well, I'm not close enough to those investigations to make any informed comment about that. I think the main point is culture matters, and the industry and the regulatory community alike together have to redress the sense that culture has not in the past been as it should be, and we've got to get to a better future. The sooner we can do that, the better for all, I think.
Thank you. We've got time,
but I don't want to comment.
Time for just two more questions. So we'll bundle together the last two from the audience. Yes. No. We'll have somebody maybe more towards the back. Yes, please, gentleman there again with glasses.
Chris Fink from IFR. One of the big developments of central banking is how so many more central banks are now in charge of banking supervision, such as in the UK and Europe. Do you see potential conflicts of interest when the major providers of liquidity are also deciding on the solvency of institutions?
It's apart from my friend here from Reuters, who we will disqualify because they've had enough of a go already. I'll put the last question, if I may. China came up. What do you think about the march of the renminbi towards possible formal reserve currency status in the SDR? You have already taken the plunge, like a lot of other conservative central banks, in owning renminbi. Do you think the Chinese are doing enough to get to the confidence of the world community that this is really a currency worth investing in?
Question on whether supervision being in the central bank's a conflict of interest. I'd have thought that can be managed. There are varying countries that have varying models, and our model following the UK in 1997 is to have a separate supervisor. The UK has now decided to bring supervision back to the central bank. Perfectly sensible decision. Quick to add, we're not lobbying to or pressing to have that change in our country. The system's working just fine. I think it can work fine either way. I was never persuaded myself by the notion that the central bank being the supervisor represented that big a conflict, really. Any potential for conflict ought to be able to be managed by being clear about the mandates and the responsibilities, and then somebody has to make a judgment call as to what the course of action is at a moment of crisis. And that's either some coordinated central bank supervisor, finance minister is going to be involved surely. If you internalise one part of that in the central bank, I'm not sure that that's leads to a seriously worse outcome. I would think the outcome would be at least as good. So I've never felt that the conflict of interest argument was very strong. Having said that, I think the arrangements can work well with either a separate or an integrated supervision situation. On the RMB, I don't know what will happen with the SDR decision when the review is taken, I think, later this year. I don't think there's any doubt that the RMB is already on its way to becoming a very important global currency. It's being used for trade settlement between China and other countries. That is as yet small but growing quickly. This is going to be a very large economy, and like many other large economies, they are probably going to want to, their business people will want to say, you use our currency if you want to deal with us. Perfectly sensible. For it to fully flower in the way the dollar did, presumably one needs to get to the point where the holders of RMB can do whatever they choose with them, like you can with the dollar, more or less. And that's not the case yet, but they're moving in that direction, and I'd be very surprised if a decade or two from now we don't see the RMB as a very, very important reserve and transaction currency.
Good. Well, thank you. It seems we've got 1 minute left before the advertised ending. I'd like to put one last question. It's like one of those TV programs where you sum up the whole of your life in the final question. What is the one thing that you've learnt during your 7 years as central bank governor that you didn't know before?
It's nearly nine years, actually. I hesitate to distill down to one lesson, but stuff's more complicated than you were told.